Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
The merger of Canada's two largest telecoms, Rogers and Shaw, sparked a corporate drama of epic proportions in the spring of 2021. And the full-throttle fight for control of an empire spanned not just the boardroom, but also within a deeply divided family. Alexandra Posadsky is a telecom reporter for the Globe and Mail and helped pull back the curtain for the rest of us throughout that dust-up. She maps out the whole story in her new book. It's called Rogers versus Rogers, The Battle for Control of Canada's Telecom Empire. And Alexandra joins us now here in the studio. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you,
too. This is your first book?
It is.
Holy smokes. This is really a very good book for your first book.
Thank you very much.
I don't know whether to be very impressed or hate you. Anyway, this is a, I mean, people will obviously, because it was so public, they will know elements of this story. But you are also uncovering in this book details, many of which we did not know, and many of which the protagonists and antagonists in this story would not want to get out. So my question is, how difficult was it to get, you know, the best verifiable version of the truth?
It was certainly challenging. A number of people, of course, did not want to speak to me for this book. And
name names. Who wouldn't talk to you?
Well, I mean, if you look at the end of the book, essentially, you can see that I spoke to over 120 people, and the vast majority of them spoke only on the condition that their identities remain confidential. And it's actually easier to name names of who would speak on the record than it is to say who wouldn't speak on the record. I did get to interview the company's lead director, Robert Gemmell, on the record. I spoke to Matthew Boswell, the commissioner of competition. The remainder of them, essentially, because they are confidential, I can't say who I spoke to.
So if you did talk to Ed Rogers, the chair and basically the guy around whom much of this story flows, if you did talk to him, it was either not for attribution or off the record, or you can confirm that you did not talk to him?
All I can just say is that, you know, I spoke to over 120
okay.
people.
Okay. No, I get it. I'm not... I get it. Okay. Why do you think it's important? I mean, this is... of course, it's a big business story. Mm-hmm. It's a sad family drama at one level as well. Why do you think it's important that, you know, people in this country know what went on with this company?
Well, I think Rogers is a really significant company in this country. They touch millions of people's lives, not just through their cable and their wireless business, also through the media companies that they own, as well as through their sports empires. And, you know, they own the Rogers Center, so they employ tens of thousands of people. They're a widely held stock in people's pension funds and mutual funds. And so they're a very, very significant Canadian company. And I think that this story really raises some very interesting questions about power in this country, about the broader telecommunications industry, and then, of course, about family-controlled companies, because we have a lot of these companies in Canada that are controlled by families. And you know, I think that there's a discussion that we need to have about, you know, some of the potential drawbacks of that. Of course, there are benefits as well, but there are also challenges when you have essentially one person in charge of a massive company like this.
My first ever full-time job was for Ted Rogers, the guy at the center of this story, the scion of the Rogers empire. I was a City Hall reporter at CHFI, which he owned, and CFTR, you know, that FMAM brother sister station. And Ted was a genius, and you knew, and even me at 22 knew that. You could tell. What made him so?
Well, the thing that people really credit Ted with is this incredible ability to anticipate the future and to see things that other people can't see. So, for example, he took a big gamble by getting into wireless at a time when you know, it was not clear. I mean, now it seems so obvious in retrospect that wireless was going to be at the center of our lives, but at the time it wasn't so.
And he was talking about it 40 years ago.
And even his own wife voted against the company going into wireless. Yes. He had to invest his own money in order to do that, and he was willing to do that. He took huge risks. He was a big risk taker, and he had this sort of dogged determination from when he was very young, despite all of his numerous health challenges, to restore the Rogers family name back into prominence.
Well, you say restore the name because he's not the first Edward S. Rogers. His dad was.
Yep.
Tell us about his dad.
Well, his dad was the inventor of the first batteryless radio, and he died in his 30s of a ruptured aneurysm when Ted was just a boy. And his mother, unfortunately, effectively sold all of the family business and was left with very little. And it was her who kind of instilled in Ted this desire to regain what the family had lost.
CFRB Radio. Canada's first Rogers batteryless.
Yep.
That's what it stands for. There we go. At what point did Ted start to think about... Okay, so let me back up a step here. There's this notion that he's got to reclaim the family empire. Mm-hmm. There's this notion that he's got to make his father... the father that he, right, that he lost when he was so young, he's got to make that father proud. How do you think that animates him as he goes through his career?
Well, I think, you know, one really major aspect in which this came into play was that he was always planning for his own death, right? Because he had all of these health setbacks and because he didn't want his children to go through what he had gone through, what his mother had gone through in terms of losing everything that the family had. And so he was very, very obsessed with planning for his succession. He was very obsessed with trying to set up a structure that would allow the Rogers family to maintain control over their empire for as many generations, he writes, as tax law would allow. And so this, of course, was had two components. There was the planning for succession in terms of a CEO, and then there was arguably the even more important succession of planning who would play the role of the controlling shareholder of Rogers. And that person ends up being his first and only son, Edward.
Well, let me pick up on that, the issue of control, because Ted died, it's a long time now, 2008. Mm-hmm. Ted died, his wife Loretta, his children, Edward, the son, Melinda and Martha, they're on the board. Edward is chair of the Rogers Control Trust. Mm-hmm. Nadir Mohammed is the CEO of the company. Who's in charge?
Well, I think that's a question that a lot of employees within the company have been asking for a long time because, you know, Ted did ultimately bypass his son and, you know, tell the board that the board could decide who the CEO would be. But he indicated a strong preference for Nadir, who, of course, is not a Rogers family member. He believed that having professional management would be the way to go. And at the same time, you do have Edward in charge as the chair of the Rogers Control Trust. And so this put employees in this kind of funny position where they have a CEO and then they have this chair. And sometimes the chair and the CEO were sort of at odds with one another. And some people talked about how that, you know, could put an employee in a very awkward position if they found themselves caught in between Nadir and Edward.
Did that happen much?
As I understand, it happened not infrequently.
I guess you can understand this, right? Because on the one hand, the CEO is supposed to run the company. On the other hand, the chair, it's his name. So how did they resolve their differences when they had them?
Yeah, it's not only just that it's his name, but it's also his dad's company. Right. And obviously, Edward did make a play for the top job, as I report in some length, the extent to which he went to try to become the CEO. And he has the ability to effectively push out the CEO. And he has the ability, as we've now learned, to effectively reconstitute the entire board, or at least all of the independent directors of Rogers, through a written resolution without even holding a shareholder meeting. And so Edward is an incredibly powerful person in this whole saga. Ultimately, though, when Nadir did step down, it was, as I understand, quite amicably. He was in the role for about 5 years. And when he left, there was sort of an orderly transition into recruiting a new CEO. And that CEO, of course, was Guy Lawrence.
Who did not last long.
He lasted significantly shorter than Nadir. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of behind his back that this recruitment process for the next CEO, Joe Natale, was going on while Guy was still in the seat.
Okay, let's This is so bizarre. So we're going to talk about the butt dial now, except we're not sure it was a butt dial. Okay, let's set this up here. Joe Natale is the CEO at the time. They've got him from, he's left TELUS, right, to come to Rogers?
He's been fired from TELUS.
He's been fired from TELUS. He's now with Rogers. And he does not know, but finds out under the most bizarre circumstances, that there is a coup being plotted by Edward and Tony Staffieri, who's CFO or
CFO, yeah, CFO at the time. Chief Financial Officer.
And somehow, okay, maybe you should pick up the story here. There's an allegation of a butt-dialed phone call in which Joe hears all about the plot to get him out.
That's
what do you think really happened there?
So essentially, here's how it goes down. Joe Natale has just signed a deal for Rogers to acquire Shaw Communications. It's a $20 billion deal, right? And this is the deal of Ted Rogers' dreams. When Ted and J.R. Shaw, the founder of Shaw, essentially were building their cable empire simultaneously, there were two kind of infamous handshake deals in which they essentially carved the country into East and West. And people have always anticipated that one day those two Eastern and Western cable families would come together, and Ted had always dreamed of having a national cable empire. And so Joe thinks things are going pretty well, understandably, seeing as he's just signed this deal, and they're now waiting on regulatory approval from not one but three government regulators. And so, you know, my initial understanding, as we reported in the Globe and Mail, was that it was a butt dial. But what I have since learned is that the alleged phone call that took place was actually a butt answer. And that.
Okay, hold that thought right there, because I actually want to read an excerpt from the book in which you touch on this, and then you can pick up the story. Sheldon, bottom of page two. Let's do this. It was the end of a busy week of investor meetings, and Natale was keen to catch up with Staffieri to discuss an issue involving credit rating agencies in relation to the Shaw deal. He opened a bottle of wine, poured himself a glass, and dialed. Natale found himself on a call with Staffieri, but Staffieri didn't seem to be aware that the call was taking place. Back to you, Alex.
So according to the version of events that has emerged from Joe Natale's camp, and which is now in several sworn court affidavits, is that, you know, Staffieri is sitting there and he's talking about his plans for Rogers Communications, how he's going to remake the leadership ranks of the company when he imminently becomes the CEO of Rogers. And, you know, this is like essentially something out of a Hollywood movie, right? That you would accidentally answer a phone call inadvertently at that exact moment. And so, you know, Joe is shocked and he takes out a pen and paper and he starts scribbling down in detail what Staffieri's plans entail. This, of course, after he attempted to make his presence known to Staffieri, but Staffieri didn't hear him. And so that is one version of events. The other version of events from Tony's camp is that Joe had actually learned of the plan through some other way. There was, in fact, perhaps a phone call. It's unclear whether the call was answered. It's unclear whether, you know, Tony was actually having that kind of a conversation with the company's former chief legal officer. But the allegation from the other camp is that Joe actually went through Tony's private communications, his emails, his text messages, and found out that way.
Now, this gets doubly complicated because the board gets very split on this. Edward Rogers is backing Tony. Some of the other independent directors, like former Premier David Peterson, are backing Joe Natale. How does that drama come to the fore at this moment?
So essentially, Joe goes to Edward and he says he wants to fire Tony Staffieri. He can't trust him. And it's at that point that Edward says to Joe, don't blame Tony. This was not Tony's plan. This was my plan. And I don't agree with firing Tony, but I will work with you on an exit package if you would like to leave. Because, you know, Joe essentially makes a kind of an ultimatum. It's either I go or he goes. And so Joe is taken aback, but, you know, he's lost apparently the confidence of the chair of the board and the chair of the trust. And so that's Edward. And so he starts, you know, working with Alan Horn, the company's former chair, on an exit package. And everything seems to be going according to Edward's plan, despite the objections of David Peterson. And then things kind of change. And essentially what ends up happening is that David Peterson makes this impassioned speech at the board, and a number of other directors come forward, and they also have concerns about parting with the CEO at the time when the company is looking to consummate this major deal. And it's not just the CEO that they're going to be parting with. It's also the vast majority of the company's C-suite leadership team who, you know, were also contemplated to be exiting as part of this plan. And so some directors are very concerned that this would be very destabilizing for the company at what is essentially this crucial moment. Because nobody in the family disagrees with the plan of acquiring Shaw, right? This is the one thing that everyone is completely allied on, is the importance of this deal.
But this company is in crisis in the midst of the biggest takeover deal in the history of the country.
That's right.
That can't be good.
No, I don't think it can.
Okay, so then the board sort of divvies up and it becomes Rogers versus Rogers.
That's right.
In court. Okay, explain that. What does that mean?
Well, so what ends up happening is that the board ends up voting to remove Edward as chair, and Edward effectively decides that he's going to replace the independent directors who have gone against him. And he does so through this little known mechanism called a written shareholder resolution, which people don't realize is possible because Rogers is actually incorporated in British Columbia, which people don't know because their headquarters are here in Toronto, but they're incorporated in BC, which is something that Ted had done back in the day for various reasons, including tax reasons. And so it's the BC Corporations Act that is unique in allowing for a board to be reconstituted essentially without holding a meeting of the shareholders. Hmm. Now, even if Rogers did have a shareholder meeting, it's pretty clear what would have happened, which is that Edward would have gotten his way because 97.5% of the voting stock of Rogers is held within trusts that Edward controls. However, by having a shareholder meeting, it would have bought some time. The shareholders could have come out and asked questions, asked for some rationale as to why these changes were being contemplated, because, of course, at that point, Edward had said very little about why he wanted to make these leadership changes, and both at the management level and at the board. And so, you know, it would have allowed for greater transparency.
Well, let me pick up on that, because you've approached this book very much like a reporter. You are getting all sides. You're putting the information out there, and basically the reader is going to make up his or her own decision. But I wonder whether you came to any conclusions yourself as to, because at the end of the day, this is a bit of a story about governance and about, you know, who's allowed to do what, and is this any way to run a railroad? Did you come to any conclusions about that yourself?
Well, I mean, as a reporter, my personal belief is always in holding power to account, and it's in transparency. And one of the things that I have found surprising throughout reporting on this saga is that there's this whole Byzantine structure at the very top of Rogers Communications that doesn't allow for a lot of transparency. So, for example, when you look at the Rogers Control Trust, it has this advisory committee of 10 members. Most of these are Rogers family members and Rogers family member friends. And technically, the company does not even have to disclose changes to the structure of this committee. And so as public shareholders, those of us who own shares of Rogers that don't give the ability to vote on major decisions such as, you know, the board and leadership and major transactions and other things of that nature, you know, it would put, I believe, the Class B, the subordinated shareholders, on a more equal footing with the Class A shareholders to at least have the ability to see more of what's happening in, you know, for example, changes to this advisory committee, things that are happening at the trust level. And so, as a journalist, my main priority has been to bring as much transparency to the issue. Obviously, a lot of things that have happened here in the story, they're quite anomalous, right? We don't see this kind of very public feud in the ranks of a very wealthy, very prominent, and very powerful family in Canada very often.
Ted Rogers' daughter, Martha, was on Twitter a lot, absolutely carving her brother a new one on regular occasions. How did everybody deal with that?
Some of those tweets, actually, funny you should mention that, some of those tweets were actually submitted by Edward's lawyers in court. I mean, look, in the end, what ended up happening is that, you know, the reason why I was not able to, for instance, sit down and have, you know, lengthy on-the-record interviews with members of the Rogers family is because they had all agreed to this standstill that essentially prevented them from being able to say anything to the press that might be seen as disparaging of one another until the deal closed, because we did have this conflict break out at this very crucial moment while the deal was still in the works, and nobody wanted to jeopardize that. And so I think it was largely in response to those tweets and to a couple of interviews that Melinda gave, one to me at the Globe and another to Bloomberg, that standstill agreement came to be.
She got in trouble for doing that.
She certainly did.
Yeah, she did. You ever see the TV show Succession?
Of course I have. Obsessively.
I always thought that was a show about the Murdochs, but it turns out it might very well have been about the Rogerses. And there is a moment, do we have this clip? Are we going to play this clip? I hope we're bleeping this clip. Because, okay, set it up again. Brian Cox, who's the head of Waystar Royco, he is the head of this very dysfunctional family, but he's a phenomenal character. He gets hired by somebody to do a video for Edward Rogers. Okay, I'm not going to say any more. Let's just, okay, let's play it. Go ahead, Sheldon.
Edward, this is from Suzanne. Congratulations on your real-life succession at Rogers Communications. And also having Joe Natale to f*** the f*** off. Well done, Edward. Congratulations.
That's actually mildly bad language compared to what he has said in the TV show. But anyway, when you guys broke that story, right?
We did.
At the Globe and Mail.
That's right.
When you first saw that, first of all, okay, I know you're not going to answer this, but I'm going to ask anyway. How'd you get a hold of that?
I have my sources.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. When you first saw it, what'd you think?
For me, this was such a bizarre moment because I had been covering this saga while the third season of Succession was playing out on HBO simultaneously, which was such a crazy thing in the first place. And then when I saw this video, it was just like the walls between fiction and reality came crumbling down, because now the two storylines are crossing over into each other. And so it was this kind of mind-blowing moment for me. I think I watched that clip 4 or 5 times in a row before I even, told anyone that I had it. I don't think Joe Natale was as impressed with this clip as perhaps other people may have been.
Do you know whether Edward enjoyed the clip?
So what I reported in my book and what has come out in court files is that he sent it around to various family and friends.
Which presumably you don't do if you didn't think it was kind of cool.
That's right.
Okay.
One might assume.
I want to circle back to something you said a few minutes ago, which is one of the things your book tries to do is explain how this is not a very big country at the end of the day, right?
No.
There's a great deal of business incestuousness in this country, and your book talks a lot about it. What do you think it says about the nature of the way the super rich do business in this country?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what this book really taught me, and hopefully will teach readers, is just how cozy the Canadian business world really is, right? So you have this fight playing out in this, wealthy, prominent, and powerful family. And who's in the middle of it? You've got a former Ontario premier. You've got someone who was at the time the sitting mayor of Toronto, John Tory, who's trying to mediate the whole thing. You've got a presentation being delivered to the Rogers Control Trust Advisory Committee members by none other than Dale Lastman, who, of course, is the son of Mel Lastman. And Dale, of course,
another Toronto mayor.
Another former Toronto mayor. And Dale, of course, is on the board of MLSE, which owns some of the most profitable sports
empires. Small little $8 billion empire, yeah.
In the country. And then, of course, you've got all these connections between the telcos, right? You look at Joe Natale, who was at the helm of Rogers. He had come from running TELUS, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, there was a huge fight between TELUS and Rogers about trying to free Joe from his non-compete. And ultimately, Rogers ends up paying TELUS a bunch of money and other benefits so that Joe can come and work earlier than, the 2 years that he was contractually under his non-compete for. And then at the same time, you do have this coziness, and at the same time, you've got this kind of ruthlessness between the telecoms themselves. If you look at, for example, the lengths to which Bell and TELUS went to try to kill, slow, and shape, as they say in a TELUS presentation, the Rogers-Shaw deal. I think what's really interesting is how, the Canadian business world is so cozy and close, and yet at the same time can kind of turn on one another and be so ruthless.
Did you come to any conclusions yourself based on looking Based on your reportage, did you come to any conclusions as to whether or not the Rogers-Shaw $20 billion deal is in the interests of Canadian consumers?
I'm still torn. I think what we've seen so far has been kind of a mixed bag. The Competition Tribunal, of course, ended up coming out and saying that the deal with the divestiture of Shaw's Freedom Mobile, which was Canada's fourth largest wireless carrier, to Quebecor would actually be a positive thing for competition because Shaw just didn't have it in them to compete anymore. They wanted out. And meanwhile, Quebecor wanted to expand their telecom business outside of Quebec, make it more of a national player. And so this was seen as being good. But as a telecom consumer, I mean, you're not exactly seeing drastically lower prices. I mean, you know, when the merger was first consummated, we did see some competitive offers from Rogers and other telecoms looking to match them. But then also, you know, we've seen, we saw some elevated customer turnover, so higher churn, which means customers switching carriers more. So that's always kind of an indication of heightened competition. But then since then, we've also seen some price hikes announced by Rogers and Bell for some of their out-of-contract customers. And we've seen some comments from the Competition Bureau about how some telecom services are now costing more, particularly in Western Canada, which had been the Bureau's concern and the reason why they went in front of the tribunal and tried to block the merger. I think with deals like this, it can take a very long time before you really see what the final impact of that consolidation is going to be.
There are four Rogers kids. How well or not are they getting on these days?
Well, what we have seen, there's been some kind of changes in the family dynamic. So for one thing, Edward's oldest sister or older sister, Lisa, has joined the board. Lisa had actually backed Edward at the control trust at the family level. So she's been added to the board. And meanwhile, Melinda and Martha, the two sisters who had gone against Edward, they've agreed to step down from the board. And this is as the result of a settlement. The terms of the settlement are confidential, so we don't know what they got in exchange for stepping down, but they have now stepped down from the board. Meanwhile, sadly, Loretta, the family matriarch, has passed away, as have two of Ted's longtime lieutenants, Alan Horn and Phil Lind, who, of course, had backed Edward as well. And so what we now see with mom and dad gone and two of dad's closest friends gone, you know, this kind of current generation of Rogers kids is left on their own. And hopefully with some peace between them now that, you know, Melinda and Martha have decided to move on and do other things with their lives.
But it's unquestionably Edward's company now, isn't it?
That is correct.
I'm going to finish off on a very bizarre question way out of left field right now. Do you know how many pages your book is, not including the epilogue, like just the chapters itself? Do you know how many pages it runs?
350-ish.
Now, that's including. I mean, excluding the epilogue.
I don't.
333. Do you know their address on Bloor Street?
333. I love that.
Coincidence?
I think not.
Did you do that on purpose?
I didn't. No,
just worked out that way.
No, it's total coincidence, yeah.
I'm looking for conspiracies wherever I can find them.
Well, that's the human mind at work. That's what we all do, right?
We
look for connections.
Alex, great job. It's really a terrific read. Rogers versus Rogers, the battle for control of Canada's telecom empire. Alexandra Posadsky. Dziękuję bardzo.
Dziękuję.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.